We've been studying this UFO mystery, the modern UFO age, for 60 or so years, and we don't know answers to any of the big questions. What these things are, if they're a who they are, where they're from, and what their interest is in us. And anybody who says they really do know for sure, I'm kind of suspicious of what they're up to. The one thing we do know for sure is that the United States government and other governments around the world are very interested in these phenomena and have tried, and probably with some success, have managed to manipulate public opinion for their own purposes, maybe to distract attention away from something else they don't want us focusing on. Maybe it's a little sort of a psychological warfare. Is it possible, you have to ask, that it's all just made up? That they've just been yanking our chain all these decades for one reason or another. Well, my guest tonight will be Mark Pilkington. He's written a new book called Mirage Men, An Adventure into Paranoia, Espionage, Psychological Warfare, and UFOs. And we'll jump right into it with him right after this on Coast to Coast AM. As mentioned, the new book is called Mirage Men. Mark Pilkington is the author, and he spent a lot of time working on this thing, coming up with this theory. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, George. It's great to be on the air with you.
Hey, I read the book today. I finished it today. It's a page turner. It's fun and interesting, and especially so since I know a lot of the characters that you mentioned here and have covered a lot of the same ground over the years. But it's an excellent work. It's going to get people talking, I'm sure.
Great. I'm glad to hear you enjoyed it. In fact, you have a small cameo as giving a talk at the Laughlin UFO conference.
I saw those mentions there, and I have every intention of jumping into it with you about that. I want to begin, though, with sort of a so the audience understands your frame of reference. I mean, you're not necessarily hostile to the UFO topic, but your opinion has evolved over the years. Why don't you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like probably anyone who's had an interest in the subject, I began as something, just reading whatever I could find. This would have been in the late 1980s and early 1990s, and reading books as the internet kind of developed, finding interesting sources on the internet. And like everyone, I just wanted to make sense of what is a baffling, fascinating, and often overwhelming subject. The deeper into the material I got, actually, the sort of more I think I began to, I could say I was probably leaning towards the side of belief that this was perhaps represented some kind of intrusion into our reality by an unknown intelligence, at least unknown to most of us. Over the years, I've really done a lot of reading. It's been one of my kind of key fascinations in life. And as I began to kind of recognize the cultural and historical context of a lot of what sort of developed in the UFO story, I began to see there were clear parallels between the sort of development of the Cold War and the kind of saber-rattling and technological one-upmanship that was going on, sort of especially in those key early years, through the late 40s and 1950s, and really began to see another story emerging. And that's one of the stories I try to show to tell in Mirage Men. But I'm also, I've had my own sightings. I opened the book with, quite a, I think, quite a dramatic sighting that took place in the mid-1990s in Yosemite National Park, actually, with two friends of mine.
Describe that.
Well, we saw, actually, I first of all on my own saw what initially I thought must be some kind of perhaps something on a tripod or a balloon, but it was a perfectly round, silvery kind of mercurial sphere, probably, I'd guess, 8 feet in diameter, just sort of hanging a few feet off the ground in a sort of wooded opening in a forest. And I was actually the passenger in the car driving past. I saw this thing perfectly still, just sort of hanging there in the air, a few feet off the ground. And it was one of those sort of blink and you miss it moments. I blinked. We'd moved on. I couldn't see it for the trees. Then we went past another break in the woods, and there I could see it again, exactly as it was before. And then one more time I saw it. And yeah, this was a real uncanny moment, an intrusion into my sort of everyday reality, like something I couldn't make sense of.
A UFO then, by the strictest definition, you don't know what it was.
Absolutely, I didn't know what it was at all. And then, you know, I was mulling over this while I was actually repairing a bus tire in the car we were driving at the time, and I was actually sort of set halfway under the car, sort of adjusting the nuts and bolts, and my two friends started yelling, and I sort of popped my head up just in time to see an identical, and I would have to call it an object, kind of just sort of meandering its way, and quite low, meandering in a purposeful fashion, I should say, over the lake which we were parked up alongside, and go straight over our heads. And then as it reached a kind of rocky bluff on the other side of the road, rather than bounce into it as a balloon, I would have thought would, it kind of reached a point away from the bluff and then just sort of rolled up the side of the bus and over the side, but never without once touching it, just maintaining a kind of perfect distance from it. And then about 5 minutes later, another one following the exact same route, as if it was some kind of pre-programmed path, just silently glided over our heads, and we were able to see that these were solid-looking. I sort of thought at the time that if we'd thrown a rock at it, it would have made a sort of clanging sound rather than a rustling sound.
Well, help me understand that. I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I would have loved to have taken a picture, but I had the choice of either sort of looking at this thing or diving into the car for the camera and scrabbling around. So I chose to keep watching it. But,
and of course, that's one of the criticisms, isn't it? That, well, why aren't there more pictures of it? Whereas in reality, people look at it and poof, it's gone.
Yeah, and you've got, you know, a matter of a few seconds to watch this thing, and you have to decide over your own memories. And as we know, you know, almost all UFO pictures end up as unsatisfying blobs or dots or kind of specks of light against an open background and are very hard to make much sense of.
Absolutely. So as a young man, you're fascinated by it. You're hooked on the subject. You're reading everything you can. And you think that there really is something to it, that it's a genuine mystery. You've come a long way since then. I'd just be curious whether you now, as you outlined in the book, I mean, a lot of these cases, major cases, landmark cases, you sort of say, hey, this maybe wasn't a UFO. It could very easily be something that the government created. Are you to the point where you don't believe any of them are legitimately mysterious, or that it could not be mysterious, that the government's basically responsible for all of them?
No, I certainly not. I mean, I don't think there's anybody in a position to be able to sort of lay claim to knowing what's behind every single UFO incident. However, what I do think if we look carefully at say a lot of the kind of the really iconic incidents and cases, you can at the very least, and partly what I've tried to do in the book is just try to present a kind of alternative context for some of these events, and one that's perhaps less out of this world, shall we say, than the kind of extraterrestrial explanation. And I'm certainly no debunker. I'm very, very sympathetic to a lot of the ideas that are batted around within the UFO lore and culture, but I do think, you know, it may be helpful to present alternatives, possibilities, and explanations to these things. And ultimately, especially when we start looking at, the possibilities of military and intelligence sort of dabbling within the field, then we can possibly whittle away some of the kind of disinformation and chaff that sort of that spread around in the field, and try to get to a better understanding of the core phenomena of what really lies at the heart of the mystery.
Well, good. You and I are on the same page on that one. Tell me how you got on the trail of the Mirage Men, which is a great title, by the way. You and a friend of yours, John Lundberg, I guess you had been involved with a group of circle makers, right?
Yes, and John has been, and this may come as a shock to some of your listeners, but John has been making very elaborate and spectacular crop circles since the early 1990s, and I got involved actually as a journalist in the later 1990s, and I stopped making them a few years ago, I should point out. But yeah, John was actually making a film about another fascinating character in the UFO field called Henry Azzardeddle. He's a British man based in Nottingham who, in the early 1990s, wrote a lot of quite influential sort of UFO articles under the name Armin Victorian.
Oh
And
yeah.
he
Yeah,
probably come
Oh
across.
yeah, I was on the receiving end of some of those. Yeah, he is sort of a notorious character, right?
Yeah, and John became fascinated with his story largely because Henry or Armin had got involved with crop circle research and was actually quite notorious for being able to do things like, dig up obscure bits of information about people in the research field and this kind of thing. There were always rumors about his involvement with the intelligence agencies or questions about what he was doing. So John was exploring these, the kind of sort of paradox of a man who sort of ran a grocery store in Nottingham by day and sort of by night was talking to CIA agents and people in the intelligence and military fields. And he was making a film like this and spoke to someone who had been involved with Henry back in the day from the intelligence community, who said to John, well, perhaps you should be, if you're interested in characters like this, perhaps you should be making a film about Richard Doty. And John wasn't aware of who this person was, and we would have regular meetings to discuss things. And I said, well, what can you tell me about this man? And he was someone I'd been very interested in and knew a fair bit about. And we got and so that got us interested in the whole notion of disinformation and deception within the UFO field. And Mirage Men kind of began from there, really, as our almost it's sort of partly a road trip into the history of this idea. We sort of set off and started tracking down whatever information that we could on this aspect of the phenomenon.
Here's how you describe this in your book. You said, I swallowed my baked beans, had a gulp of tea, took a deep breath, and began talking. Richard C. Doty was a Mephistophelian character who haunted the underworld of UFO literature. To some, Doty was a dark knight caught between the intelligence world that he'd once operated in and the world of the UFO researchers to whom he provided incredible information about the alien presence on Earth. To others, he was a pariah, a tool of the government conspiracy, a sower of disinformation, and a traitor to the cause of shattering UFO secrecy. Have you made up your mind which one he is? And I know that's
No,
jumping ahead, but.
absolutely not. I mean, after completely confounding our expectations, we really had no inkling that we would ever get to meet Rick. And we did actually at the Laughlin UFO conference in 2006 in Laughlin, Nevada, and spent a lot of time with him during the course of that week. And all I can say is after a week and a few more days spent with him, sort of after that, I'm still no clearer as to exactly what his kind of role in the story is. And, well, sorry, I should say I'm much clearer about what his role in the story that he's best known for, getting involved with an Air Force officer's special investigations campaign against a man called Paul Benowitz in the early 1980s. I think, have a clearer understanding of that. But as to Rick's own beliefs and kind of whether he's still got an active role to play in the UFO story, I am no clearer, I'm afraid. He remains an enigma and a fascinating one.
Absolutely. I mean, Rick Doty's name popped up as soon as I got into this field, which is 1987, 88. That was a hotbed time. And 2 years later, Bill Moore came forward with some amazing revelations at a MUFON conference. I want to go sort of step by step through that period, because that sort of is the story that hooked you and which you've been on the trail of ever since. Tell us who Rick Doty is, what his background is. And I should point out, by the way, in fairness to Rick, that we have asked him several times to be on the program. I know he was on Coast to Coast some years ago. He called in to an interview program, but he's declined our requests that he join us over the past couple of years. But go ahead and start telling us, filling us in on who Rick Doty is.
I can't give you information about his place of birth or date of birth, because that's not on the record. Though there are various stories, including one that I love, that he was born in Roswell, New Mexico,
Right.
of all places,
Right.
which is which was great. But no, Rick was working in the late 70s and early 80s as a special agent for the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, who are most usually described as a kind of FBI, internal FBI for the Air Force, and their role is primarily kind of policing Air Force bases and maintaining the security of those bases. And this can sometimes involve policing, you know, Air Force personnel and staff themselves, and at other times it is about, you know, maintaining kind of security from outsiders at the bases. So he was working at Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque, and Kirtland was a kind of center for some fairly advanced research and development, and also at the time was a storage site for a large number of nuclear warheads, and was one of the larger kind of containment areas in the U.S. for these, but they but, and still is, but they've moved to another location on the base now. But in the early 1980s, probably about 1980, a man called William Moore, who was a highly respected UFO investigator and researcher, who had just published the first book on the Roswell crash called The Roswell Incident, along with co-author Charles Berlitz, was doing the rounds, doing kind of radio interviews and publicity for the book, when he was effectively summoned to a meeting in Albuquerque between a mysterious figure known only as the Falcon and then later Rick Doty. And these two men basically offered him a deal, or at least in, as far as we know sort of the detail of the story, offered him a deal, which was that he would provide information about the kind of current research and investigations of, that was going on within the UFO community in exchange for ultimately being rewarded with sort of insider knowledge from the Air Force or from the Department of Defense about what was known about UFOs. And over the next few years, this became a more complex kind of scenario where Bill Moore was, for example, asked to spread what he knew to be false documents into the, or at least one, certainly one false document into the kind of bloodstream of the UFO community, and it became a kind of Faustian pact, if you like.
Just to sort of see, just to spread it to see where it went. We're talking with Mark Pilkington, author of the new book Mirage Men, about disinformation, psychological warfare, paranoia, how it all works in the UFO field. Stay with us for a lot more here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking about disguises, deceptions, misdirections, subterfuge in the area of UFOs with Mark Pilkington, author of the new book Mirage Men, on the trail of perhaps the ultimate Mirage Man, Rick Doty, a really interesting character in the history of ufology. We'll get back into the discussion right after this on Coast to Coast. My guest is Mark Pilkington, author of the new book, Mirage Men. We're talking before the break about Rick Doty, a really interesting character in the history of ufology. He worked for AFOSI, Air Force Office of Special Investigations, and seemed to be in the disinformation business, at least for a while. The question is whether he's still in it now, years later, and it's a tough nut to crack. I will say, Mark, that I've met Rick Doty. I've communicated with him, corresponded with him over the years. I think he's a really interesting character, and I don't think the real story about Rick Doty is known yet.
No, and I'd agree. And I also was thinking about this while we're on the break. I think, you know, it's unfair in some ways for us to place so much kind of onus or weight on Rick's shoulders. And, you know, and one of the big questions that's always asked is whether, you know, Rick was some kind of sort of maverick disinformation agent, or whether he was sort of working as part of a team or as part of a chain of command. And one of the things, certainly back in the early 80s, one of the things I'm quite confident in saying is that he was certainly part of a team and probably reasonably sort of low down on a chain of command that I think went sort of all the way up to the top. And Rick's sort of role, I think, was very much as a sort of what's known in other areas as a sort of contact officer. He was there to kind of talk to people, to communicate with William Moore, the UFO researcher, and Dr. Paul Benowitz, the engineer who was targeted by this particular operation to spread disinformation into the UFO community.
Okay, so Rick Doty is spreading disinformation using Bill Moore as a conduit for information. Bill Moore, in turn, is giving him information about what's going on in the UFO field, essentially spying on his fellow UFO researchers and organizations, right?
Yes. And I think at the time, you know, it must have been a very tempting proposition. Bill Moore was kind of lured and baited by AFOSI with the promise of more information. And I think this was a sort of irresistible to any kind of, conscientious researcher as he was, though it was a difficult line to tread. But, and what seemed harmless initially, which was just sort of telling the Air Force what was interesting people in the UFO field, did to take a darker turn, a much darker turn, with that information being kind of twisted and garbled and then fired back into the UFO community within the form of altered government documents and rumors of all sorts of dark goings on, particularly in New Mexico.
Okay, well, let's get into some of that. Let's start with Benowitz, though. First of all, tell us who Paul Benowitz was, what he was thought he was onto, and how ultimately that led to bad things for him.
Yeah, and Paul Benowitz was, by all accounts, a very brilliant man. He was an engineer who ran his own company, Thunder Scientific, which is actually based on the edge of Kirtland Air Force Base, and still is actually, and you can still see the sign there. And he was the company Thunder Scientific manufactured sort of instrumentation and parts for aircraft for the Air Force and for NASA and for other organizations. And in the sort of mid to late 1979, Benowitz lived right on the edge of the base, about just downtown from the outside, and so had a clear view from his kind of deck out over much of Kirtland Air Force Base. And in the summer of 79, he began noticing strange lights kind of flying around over the part of the base nearest his house, near the Manzano storage area, which is actually a kind of two mountains with a huge kind of nuclear bunker cut into them, where at the time nuclear warheads were stored. So Benowitz was seeing strange lights flying around and began filming them, and he also began picking up odd radio signals and emissions, which he connected intuitively to these lights he was seeing. And being a good citizen and a patriot, which he was, he sort of contacted the security people at Kirtland and said, look, I've got something here I think you ought to see. And very quickly they arranged a meeting with him, and they sort of discussed what these might be, and told him to just sort of keep at it, keep filming them and keep them informed. And what effectively happened was that AFOSI encouraged Benowitz in his belief that these lights were in fact belonging to extraterrestrial craft that were flying over the area, and indeed had a kind of malevolent intention and were planning some kind of sort of invasion or attack. This became something of an obsession for Benowitz, and over the years, his sort of state of mind really deteriorated quite badly until in the, I think it was 1986, he was institutionalized for a month in a mental hospital.
So Benowitz thinks that he's seeing UFOs over the Manzano weapons storage area, does the good thing and tells the Air Force about it. He thinks it might be a threat to nuclear weapons. They take advantage of it and lead him down this path, they being Rick Doty and Bill Moore. And they sort of feed his obsession, and it leads to dire consequences, or at least it ends in dire consequences for Benowitz.
Yeah, and I think for the entire UFO research field, because much of the information that Benowitz was being fed and then himself generating was sort of pumped into the field and spread a lot of, you know, outrageous and quite frightening ideas and very sensational ideas into the UFO research field. And these are ideas that are still with us today. So ideas of underground alien bases.
Dulce base, right?
Exactly, Dulce, New Mexico. Genetic and experimentation and abduction of humans and cattle, sort of sinister bargains and deals between the U.S. government and these extraterrestrials, or between a cabal within the U.S. government and these extraterrestrials. So a lot of popular ideas that are still sort of with us, and these were seeded, you know, we're talking nearly 30 years ago now, 25 years ago now.
You know, a lot of people look at, for example, the MJ-12 documents or the Aquarius document that a lot of our listeners would be familiar with, and they say, well, you know, even if these were made up, there are elements of truth to them. You think there are elements of truth, or they're just completely fabricated for whatever reasons?
I would lean towards B, that they were completely fabricated to create a kind of smokescreen and to lure the UFO research community away from what was at the time the sort of most important and critical development in Air Force technology yet developed, which was the stealth program. And actually, I think if you kind of chart the sort of development of the stealth program from the late 70s through to the late 80s and this really intense period of information warfare kind of conducted against the UFO community, you see they match up quite well. And I think that might be what was at the root of this whole business.
You know, I've heard that story probably 500 times, especially as it relates to Area 51, which I've reported on a lot over the years. Sure. Well, Lazar and his story was certainly, you know, has links to Doty and Moore and all that stuff. It's a kind of a convoluted path, but you can trace it back. Lazar was fed this information to distract attention away from something else going on at Area 51. And I always thought, wow, that really blew up in their face, because if they didn't want attention or people focusing on Area 51, where stealth was tested and developed and flown, they really messed up, because the UFO stories gathered far more attention, worldwide attention, than anything they could have possibly done, because the whole world beat a path to that base's door and are still doing it, looking for whatever is floating around out there in the sky.
Absolutely. I was actually one of them back in 95. I got as far as the space perimeter until the guys in their white vans sort of chased us off again, and I was lured like everybody else. And I mean, I think the period I'm talking about is really one that predates Bob Lazar and the Area 51 story. And what I and others would suggest is that all the stories about Dulce and in a remote town in New Mexico were actually designed to act in the same way as a lure away from the actual real testing and flying of the stealth, which was taking place around Area 51 and Tonopah and from hundreds of miles away. And again, worked because it wasn't until much later that Area 51, for whatever reason, and the Lazar story is a fascinating one and a puzzling one, for whatever reason, people were drawn to Area 51 at a later time, but by which point stealth was pretty much out in the open.
Well, actually, you're off a little bit on the time, but I'll grant you the point for now. Let's talk a little bit back more about Doty. Now, Doty was also involved in feeding disinformation or misinformation or dangling out the possibility of some big disclosure to other UFO researchers, right? Or there were offers made that, aha, you'll be the one to get the film of the UFO landing, or both to Linda Howe and Robert Emmenegger.
Yeah, certainly. Emmenegger, his story sort of much earlier from the early 70s, but yes, Linda Moulton Howe was kind of targeted by Doty and presumably by AFOSI in the early 80s when she was actually hired or in negotiations anyway with HBO to make a what was meant to be a sort of blockbusting, truth-busting documentary called The E.T. Factor. And as we know, Linda had made a very interesting and successful documentary about the cattle mutilation phenomenon, which in itself had been just stirred up by the tales emerging from Dulce, New Mexico, and spread partly anyway by Paul Benowitz. And so Linda's was very much on AFOSI and Doty's radar. And some of the documents that had been generated with the information provided by Bill Moore were presented to her, and these, and in her own words, the documents blew her mind, and she was presented them in a very kind of staged environment where she was sitting in a chair, and she makes the point that Doty insisted she sit in a particular chair, and that was one that conveniently put her in place of a two-way mirror on the other side of which his associates were watching and possibly filming her response to the presentation of these documents. And that was actually one of the sort of last projects that Doty got involved in. The other person, was involved with this evening was members of CALS, Systems Against UFO Secrecy, who were a legal group trying to kind of pry open the government's secret files. And so she was actually tried to become a member of CALS and work with them in a sort of strange attempt to kind of infiltrate their world. But it was around this time that the whole sort of that Doty was actually exposed and his operations had to sort of come to an end.
Does it constitute sort of a psychological warfare program? Because in addition to trying to distract attention away from stealth or other legitimate national security programs and efforts, that they were also maybe examining how information spreads. Maybe trying to figure out if these UFO people are crazy enough to be dangerous.
Yes, I think there's certainly aspect to that, and I think if you think about what UFO researchers and people interested in the UFO story are trying to do, it's identify unknown or mysterious aircraft, and this is something obviously that on one level the Air Force. Part of their job is to identify mysterious aircraft that are approaching or within their airspace. But but also they don't want anyone else identifying their advanced or secret aircraft. And I think one of the purposes of the late 70s to early 80s kind of program against the UFO community was to throw out so much disinformation and chaff that the real signal was hidden and muddied under all the dust kicked up by their own stories. And this, I think, goes back right as far back as the early 50s and possibly even the late 40s. And while I don't think there's a kind of single kind of department whose job it is to kind of promote and spread UFO stories, I think that they are one of the kind of tools that are, or one of the sort of disguises pulled out of the government dressing up box as and when it's appropriate for them to do so. So yes, certainly early on in 1950 to 1953, there was a lot of concern about the psychological impact that the fear about UFOs was and having and could have on the population.
Sure. The 1953 Robertson panel, and you mentioned that in your book, the CIA panel studies UFOs, and I think that they decide that UFOs don't look like they're a threat to national security, but the continued public interest in UFOs could be a threat to national security, which is why they needed to be debunked, right?
Yes, exactly. And, I think one of the sort of key sort of interesting points from the Robertson panel report was their question of what exactly the Soviets who were doing about UFOs. And one of the things that distressed or disturbed them most of all was that while American newspapers were literally flooded with stories about UFOs and flying saucers, as they were called at the time, the Soviet press had next to nothing about the subject, which led them to wonder if some of the stories at least weren't being sort of spread by the Soviets. And I think this was one of the key concerns in the early days of the UFO story. And indeed, I would propose that was why Kenneth Arnold, the sort of man who first sort of spotted and started the flying saucer craze in 1947, one of the reasons he was kind of investigated and pursued in what's known as the Maori Island incident.
Yeah, so you think that there was disinformation and subterfuge right from the beginning, that even Kenneth Arnold, the first guy in the modern UFO era to see something like UFOs, was sort of targeted and watched and messed with?
Yes, exactly. I think he was, because what's really interesting, and so one of the sort of many parallel stories I'm sort of telling in the book, is the sort of development of the idea that UFOs or flying saucers indeed came from outer space. And what's fascinating is that in the early days, really for the first year or so of the modern UFO era, most people really thought that UFOs were experimental American aircraft or possibly Soviet aircraft, and the idea that they were from outer space kind of came gradually later. And when after Arnold's sort of epoch-making fighting in June 1947, he spoke a lot to the press, and some of the things he was saying were probably unacceptable to those concerns of national security, because he was talking about experimental American atomic-powered aircraft, for example, which he wouldn't have known that the Army Air Force were actually already kind of looking into the possibility.
Hey, Mark, we're going to take a break. Yeah. We're going to take a break. Okay. When we come back, I want to jump into some of the cases that you cover in Mirage Man, because there are icons in the world of ufology, Roswell in Iran, for example, some more recent controversies, the aviary and Serpo. And I want to challenge you about some of the things you write in the book about them. So hang with us, everyone. We'll be back with more Coast to Coast AM.